From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Johnny Cash talks about his childhood, his music, and his faith. He's back in the studio recording a new CD. In the meantime, he has new reissues. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan considers the Harry Potter phenomenon. The new book hits stores at midnight tonight. And we remember dancer Harold Nicholas with a 1985 interview. As half of the duo The Nicholas Brothers, he was famous for his splits, leaps, and acrobatic moves. Harold Nicholas died Monday at the age of 79. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Tonight, Pentagon testers try again to shoot down a ballistic missile in space. The first try worked. The second failed. This third test could affect whether President Clinton agrees to deploy a multi-billion-dollar defense. NPR's Steve Inskeep reports.
Testers in California will fire a missile with a fake warhead into the darkening Pacific sky. Several thousand miles away, on a Pacific island, testers will fire a second rocket, and they'll try to smash the first. This is the final test before the president decides whether to go ahead with the much-debated technology. But both critics and supporters are suggesting this test doesn't really matter that much. Some independent scientists say the test doesn't use very many decoys that a real enemy would use in a real attack. So even if the test succeeds, critics still say the defense won't work. And Pentagon officials say even if the test fails, the system still might work. They could recommend the president approve it even if the two missiles pass harmlessly in space. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, Washington.
The Army says a major general who was accused of sexual harassment has asked to retire. Major General Larry Smith was given a written reprimand after the Army said it found evidence to substantiate Lieutenant General Claudia Kennedy's charge that he made an unwanted sexual advance to her in 1996. He has denied the allegation but said he chose to retire for the good of the Army. A major drug company said today it will provide an AIDS drug for free to developing nations to reduce the spread of HIV from mothers to infants. NPR's Richard Knox reports from Durban, South Africa.
1,700 infants are born every day with HIV, almost all of them in developing nations. For years, scientists have known that giving anti-AIDS drugs to pregnant women can reduce the chances a baby will be born infected. One recent study projected that a single dose of the drug nevirapine, given during labor, could prevent 100,000 infections among South African infants. That's over 5 years. But South African officials say they can't afford the cost, $4 per treatment. Now, on the eve of the International AIDS Conference here, the German drug maker Boehringer Ingelheim said it will donate nevirapine to any developing nation that wants it. Many questions remain, especially how to prevent babies from acquiring HIV through breastfeeding. United Nations officials say the company's offer holds out great hope for millions of women. Richard Knox, NPR News, Durban, South Africa.
Sheriffs in Florida say they've positively identified a body found in a car at the bottom of a pond as that of Corey Irving, the son of basketball star Julius Irving. The cause of death hasn't been established, but authorities say there's no evidence to indicate foul play or a suicide. They say the death may have been an accident. The 19-year-old has been missing since late May. In stocks today, the Dow gained 154 points, or nearly 1.5%, to close at 10,636 in moderate trading. This is NPR News. NASCAR driver Kenny Irwin was killed today in a crash at the New Hampshire International Speedway. The 30-year-old driver lost control on a turn just a few yards from the spot where racer Adam Petty was killed 2 months ago. At least one other driver says the two accidents show the turn is unnecessarily dangerous and should be redesigned. A controversial loan package for China has fallen apart. That's after directors of the World Bank, in opposition to a management recommendation, decided not to accept further conditions on a plan to relocate tens of thousands of farmers. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
Contentious from the start, the loan package called for nearly 60,000 farmers to be resettled on land viewed as sacred by Tibet. Now, after several days of effort aimed at brokering a deal, World Bank officials say the proposal has fallen apart. Directors rejected the $160 million loan package, around $40 million of which would have gone toward resettling farmers in an area inhabited by both Tibetans and Mongol herders. The farmers, some of whom were Chinese, were to have been moved to the province that is the birthplace of the Dalai Lama, Tibet's exiled spiritual leader. The U.S. government opposed the resettlement program, as did a group of Tibetans who rallied earlier this month near the White House. World Bank President James Wolfensohn had repeatedly sought to quiet criticism over the loan. China now says it will come up with its own money to carry out the resettlement program. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Temperatures eased a bit today in southeastern Europe, but forecasters say the region is in for more hot weather over the weekend. Hot winds from the Sahara Desert brought temperatures as high as 113 degrees, resulting in at least 38 deaths in the area. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Travelocity.com, offering airline, hotel, and rental car reservations and featuring FareWatcher email and dream maps. Travelocity.com. Go virtually anywhere.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we have a 1997 interview with Johnny Cash. He's done little performing since then because of health problems. According to his business office, he has diabetic autonomic neuropathy, which damages nerve tissues. But Cash is back in the studio making a new CD. And this week, his classic recording, Live from San Quentin, was reissued. Here he is in San Quentin Prison in 1969.
I was thinking about you guys yesterday. Well, I'd been here three times before, and I think I understand a little bit how you feel about some things. It's none of my business how you feel about some other things. And I don't give a damn how you feel about some other things. But anyway, I tried to put myself in your place, and I believe this is the way that I would feel about San Quentin. San Quentin, you've been living hell to me. You blistered me since 1963. I've seen them come and go, and I've seen them die. And long ago I stopped asking why. San Quentin, I hate every inch of you. You cut me and you scarred me through and through. And I'll walk out a wiser, weaker man. Mr. Congressman, you can't understand.
Johnny Cash is in the Country Music Hall of Fame and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. His biggest hits include I Walk the Line, Jackson, Ring of Fire, Ballad of Ira Hayes, and Folsom Prison Blues. As Cash said in his autobiography, between the early 70s and the early 90s, he didn't sell huge numbers of records, but he kept making music he's proud of. But then he hooked up with record producer Rick Rubin, who had produced many rap and rock hits. As the autobiography says, the Cash and Rubin collaborations transformed Cash's image from Nashville has-been to hip icon. Let's hear a song from his first recording with Rubin. This is Why Me, Lord, and it's included on one of three new Cash compilation CDs featuring tracks chosen by Cash himself. Each CD collects songs on a subject: love, murder, and God.
Why me, Lord? What have I ever done to deserve even one of the blessings I've known? Why me, Lord? What did I ever do that was worth love from you and the kindness you've shown? Lord, help me, Jesus, I've wasted it. So help me, Jesus, I know what I am. Now that I know that I've needed you, so help me, Jesus, my soul's in your hand. Try me, Lord. If you think there's a
Your career has in many ways been about both the sacred and the profane. you've always been Christian and have always sung hymns. And on the other hand, there were times in your life when, as you write in your book, when you'd been in and out of jails, hospitals, car wrecks, when you were a walking vision of death, and that's exactly how you felt, you say in your mm-hmm. book. Have you always been aware of that contradiction, you know, of the sacred and the profane running through your life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Christofferson wrote a song, and in that song was a line that says, wrote the song about me. He's a walking contradiction, partly truth and partly fiction. And I've always explored various areas of society, and I love the young people, and I had an empathy for prisoners, and did concerts for them. Back when I thought that it would make a difference, you know, that that they really were there to be rehabilitated.
You grew up during the Depression. What are some of the things that your father did to make a living while you were a boy?
My father was a cotton farmer first, and but he didn't have any land, or what land he had, he lost it in the Depression. So he worked as a woodman and cut pulp wood for the paper mills, rode the rails in boxcars, going from one harvest to another to try to make a little money picking fruit or vegetables. Did every kind of work imaginable, from painting to shoveling to herding cattle. And he's always been such an inspiration to me because of the varied kinds of things that he did and the kind of life he lived. He inspired me so that all the things he did, so far from being a soldier in World War I to being an old man in his patio sitting on the porch watching the dogs, you know, I think about his life, and it would inspire me to go my own other direction.
You know, it's interesting that you say your father inspired you so much. I'm sure you wouldn't have wanted to lead his life picking cotton.
I did. Until I was 18 years old, that is.
Mm-hmm.
Then I picked the guitar, and I've been picking it since.
Right. You have such a wonderful, deep voice. Did you start singing before your voice changed?
Oh, yeah. I got no deep voice today. I've got a cold. But when I was so young, I had a high tenor voice. I used to sing Bill Monroe songs. And I sang Dennis Day songs. Like,
oh, no.
songs that he sang on the Jack Benny show.
Wow.
Every week he sang an old Irish folk song. And next day in the fields, I'd be singing that song if I was working in the fields. And I always loved those songs, and with my high tenor, I thought I was pretty good, you know, almost as good as Dennis Day. But when I was 16, my father and I cut wood all day long, and I was swinging that crosscut saw and hauling wood. And when I walked in the back door late that afternoon, I was singing, "Everybody gonna have religion and glory, everybody gonna be singing a story." I sang those old gospel songs for my mother, and she said, "Is that you?" And I said, "Yes, ma'am." And she came over and put her arms around me and said, "God's got his hands on you." I still think of that, you know?
She realized you had a gift.
That's what she said, yeah. She called it the gift.
Well, how did you feel about your voice changing? It must have stunned you. If you were singing like Dennis O'Day, and then suddenly you were singing like Johnny Cash.
I don't know. I guess when I was a tenor, I just, and when it changed, I thought, well, it goes right along with these hormones, and everything's working out really good, you know. I felt like my voice was becoming a man's voice.
Right, right. So did you start singing different songs as your voice got deeper?
Mm-hmm. Lucky Old Son, Memories Are Made of This. 16 tons. I developed a pretty unusual style, I think. If I'm anything, I'm not a singer, but I'm a song stylist.
What's the difference?
Well, I say I'm not a singer, so that means I can't sing. But doesn't it?
Well, but I mean, that's not true. I understand you're making a distinction, but you certainly can sing. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. Well, song stylist is like to take an old folk song like Delia's Gone and do a modern white man's version of it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
a lot of those I did that way. You know, I would take songs that I'd loved as a child and redo them in my mind for the new voice I had, the low voice.
I know that you briefly took singing lessons, and you say in your new book that your singing teacher told you, you know, don't let anybody change your voice. Don't even bother with the singing lessons. How did you end up taking lessons in the first place?
My mother did that, and she was determined that I was going to leave the farm and do well in life, and she thought with the gift I might be able to do that. So she took in washing. She got a washing machine in 1942, as soon as they got electricity. And she took in washing. She washed the school teacher's clothes and anybody she could, and sent me for singing lessons for $3 per lesson. And that's how she made the money to send me.
What was your reaction when the teacher told you, don't let anybody change what you're doing? Don't, you know, I'm not going to teach you anymore.
I was pretty happy about that. I didn't really want to change, you know. I felt good about my voice.
My guest is Johnny Cash. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1997 interview with Johnny Cash. You left home when you were about 18. And then how old were you when you actually went to Memphis?
Well, I went to Memphis after I finished the Air Force in 1954.
Mm-hmm.
I lived on that farm until I went to the Air Force. I was in there four years, and when I came back, I got married and moved to Memphis. Got an apartment. Started trying to sell appliances at a place called Home Equipment Company, but I couldn't sell anything and didn't really want to. All I wanted was the music, and if somebody in the house was playing music when I would go come, I would stop and sing with them. Like one time, Gus Cannon, the man who wrote Walk Right In,
mm-hmm.
which was a hit for the Rooftop Singers, and I sat on the front porch with him day after day when I found him and sing those songs.
When you got to Memphis, Elvis Presley had already recorded That's All Right. Sam Phillips had produced him for his label Sun Records. You called Sam Phillips and asked for an audition. Did it take a lot of nerve to make that phone call?
No, it just took the right time. I was fully confident that I was going to see Sam Phillips and to record for him, that when I called him, I thought, I'm going to get on Sun Records. So I called him, and he turned me down flat. Then 2 weeks later, I called, turned down again. He told me over the phone that he couldn't sell gospel music, so because it was independent, not a lot of money, you know. So I didn't press that issue, but one day I just decided I'm ready to go. So I went down with my guitar and sat on the front steps of his recording studio. And met him when he came in, and I said, I'm John Cash, I'm the one that's been calling, and if you'd listen to me, I believe you'd be glad you did. And he said, come on in. Well, that was a good lesson for me, you know, to believe in myself.
What was the audition like?
It was about 3 hours of singing with just my guitar. Songs, a lot of them, like the songs that are in my first American Recordings album.
So what did Phillips actually respond to most of the songs that you played him?
He responded most to a song of mine called Hey Porter, which was on the first record. But he asked me to go write a love song or maybe a bitter weeper. So I wrote a song called Cry, 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 went back in and recorded that for the other side of the record.
You say in your book you had to do 35 takes of Cry, Cry, Cry. Why did it take so many takes?
It was too simple. We were trying to make something complicated out of it. It was the simplest song in the world ever written. And invariably, at some time during a take, the guitar player would mess up, or the bass player, or I would mess up, and we'd have to do it over. It's not unusual, though, to do a song 35 times.
Were you nervous because it was your first recording?
No, not at all. I had confidence that I was going to do it. I'd been singing in Germany in the Air Force. I'd been singing with my little group called the Landsberg Barbarians. And we played in honky-tonks and guest houses and wherever we could, you know, when we weren't working.
Well, why don't we hear Cry, 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 which was on the first single that Sun Records released by you.
Okay.
Everybody knows where you go when the sun goes down. I think you only live to see the lights uptown. I wasted my time when I would try, try, try. 'Cause when the lights have lost their glow, you'll cry, cry, cry. Soon your sugar daddies will all be gone. You wake up some cold day and find you're alone. You'll call for me, but I'm gonna tell you bye, bye, bye. When I turn around and walk away, you'll cry, cry, cry. You're gonna cry, 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 and you cry alone. When everyone's forgotten and you're left on your own, you're gonna cry, cry, cry.
That's Johnny Cash, his first single. And Johnny Cash has a new autobiography, which is called Cash, the Autobiography. So this record was the beginning of your recording career. What was it like when you started to go on tour? You know, after coming from the cotton fields, it's true. I mean, you'd been in the Army and you'd been abroad, you know, with the Army. But what was it like for you in the early days of getting recognized, you know, traveling around the country?
Well, when I started playing concerts, I went out from Memphis to Arkansas, Louisiana, and Tennessee, played the little towns there that I would go out myself in my car and set up the show or get the show booked in those theaters. And then along about 3 months later, Elvis Presley asked me to sing with him at the Overton Park Shell in Memphis. And I sang Cry, 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 and Hey Porter. And from that time on, I was on my way, and I knew it, I felt it, and I loved it. So Elvis asked me to go on tour with him, and I did. I worked with Elvis four or five tours in the next year or so. And I was always intrigued by his charisma. You know, I just, you can't be in the building without looking at him, you know? And he inspired me so that with his fire and energy that I guess that inspiration from him really helped me to go.
It's funny. I think of your charisma and his charisma as being very different forms of charisma because, I mean, he would move around so much on stage, and I think of your charisma as being a very kind of still, stoic kind of charisma.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm an old man to him. I'm 4 years older than he was. So I was 23 when I started recording, and Elvis was 19. And I was married. He wasn't. So we didn't have a lot in common family life.
Mm-hmm.
But we liked each other and appreciated each other, so he asked me to tour with him.
Did you want that kind of adulation that he was getting from girls who would come see him?
I don't remember if I wanted it, but I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I did. But I only got it to a very small degree compared to Elvis.
Right. What were the temptations like for a young married man like yourself on the road, you know, slowly becoming a star?
Fame was pretty hard to handle, actually. The country boy in me tried to break loose and take me back to the country, but the music was stronger. The urge to go out and do the gift was a lot stronger. And the temptations were women, girls, which I loved, and then amphetamines, not very much later, from running all night, you know, in our cars on tour, and the doctors got these nice pills that give us energy and keep us awake. So I started taking those, and I liked them so much I got addicted to them. And then I started taking downers or sleeping pills to come down and rest after 2 or 3 days. So it became a cycle. I was taking the pills for a while, and then the pills started taking me.
I want to play what I think was your first big hit, I Walk the Line.
Mm-hmm. That was my third record.
And tell you wrote this song. Tell me the story of how you wrote it and what you were thinking about at the time.
In the Air Force, I had an old Wilcox J recorder, and used to hear guitar runs on that recorder going dun-dun-dun-dun, like the chords on I Walk the Line. And I always wanted to write a love song using that theme, you know, that tune. And so I started to write the song, and I was in Gladewater, Texas one night with Carl Perkins, and I said, I've got a good idea for a song. And I sang him the first verse that I had written, and I said, it's called Because You're Mine. And he said, I Walk the Line's a better title. So I changed it to I Walk the Line.
Now, were you thinking of your own life when you wrote this?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a prodding to myself to play it straight, Johnny.
And was this, I think I read that this was supposed to be a ballad. I mean, it was supposed to be slow when you first wrote it.
That's the way I sang it, yeah, at first. But Sam wanted it up, you know, up-tempo, and I put paper in the strings of my guitar to get that sound, and with a bass and a lead guitar, there it was, bare and stark, that song was, when it was released, and I heard it on the radio, and I really didn't like it. And I called Sam Phillips and asked him, please not send out any more records of that song.
Why?
But he laughed at me. I just didn't like the way it sounded to me. I didn't know I sounded that way. And I didn't like it. I don't know. But he said, let's give it a chance. And it was just a few days until that's all it took to take off.
That's funny. I mean, you'd heard your voice before, hadn't you?
Mm-hmm.
But so it was something in your own singing you weren't liking when you heard it?
Well, the music and my voice together, I just felt like it was really weird. And but I got used to it very quickly. I don't know if that I didn't hate it, but I just didn't like it. I thought I could do better.
We'll continue our 1997 interview with Johnny Cash in the second half of the show. Let's hear I Walk the Line from his 1969 performance at San Quentin Prison. The album has just been reissued. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
So what do you want to hear? All right, all right. I Walk the Line. I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds, because you're mine, I walk the line.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and from Random House Inc.'s Delacorte Books Division, publisher of Tulip Fever by Deborah Mogah, a novel about love and painting in 17th century Amsterdam. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I hear the train a-coming.
Coming up, performing in prison. We continue our 1997 interview with Johnny Cash. Book critic Maureen Corrigan discusses the Harry Potter books and hype, and we remember dancer Harold Nicholas of the Nicholas Brothers. He died Monday.
But that train keeps a-rolling on down to San Antone. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry. I
bet there's rich folks eating from a fancy dining car. They're probably drinking coffee and smoking big cigars. Well, I know.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our 1997 interview with Johnny Cash. He's back in the studio recording a new CD. In the meantime, he has new reissues. Three new CDs collect his songs about love, murder, and God. And there's a new reissue of his classic album, Live from San Quentin, featuring his 1969 performance at the prison. I think it was in the late 1950s that you started doing prison concerts, which you eventually became very famous for.
Mm-hmm.
What got you started performing in prison?
Well, I had a song called Folsom Prison Blues that was the hit just before I walked the line. And the people in Texas heard about it at the state prison and got to write me letters asking me to come down there. So I responded, and then the warden called me and asked if I would come down and do a show for the prisoners in Texas. And so we went down, and there's a rodeo at all these shows that the prisoners have there. And in between the rodeo things, they asked me to set up and do two or three songs. So that was what I did. I did Folsom Prison Blues, which they thought was their song, you know. And I walked the line, Hey Porter, Cry, Cry, Cry. And then the word got around on the grapevine that Johnny Cash was all right and that you ought to see him. So the requests started coming in from other prisoners all over the United States. And then the word got around. So I always wanted to record that, you know, to record a show. Because of the reaction I got, it was far and above anything I had ever had in my life. The complete explosion of noise and reaction that they gave me with every song.
What kind of reaction surprised you the most when you were performing for prisoners?
Well, what really surprised me was any kind of prison song, I could do no wrong. You know, if it's whatever, the prisoner song or San Quentin, a song of mine. But they felt like they could identify with me, I suppose. I sang songs like Dark as a Dungeon, or Bottom of a Mountain, songs about the working man and the hard life. And, of course, they'd been through the hard life, all of them, or they wouldn't be there. So they kind of related to all that, I guess, the songs I chose. Very little of love songs, very few. Mostly, you know, songs about the down and outer. And so then requests started coming in for me to go to other prisons, and it got overwhelming. So I decided I would do two or three, and I wouldn't do any more. Because one thing, my wife was scared to death, and the other women on the show were too, so I decided not to. It was still a great experience to get on stage and perform with those people.
You married your second wife, your wife June Carter, now June Carter Cash, in 1968. How did you first meet the members of the Carter family, the kind of first family of country music?
I met June at the backstage at the Grand Ole Opry when I did my first appearance as a guest artist. And it was 5 years again, 5 years more till I saw her again. And we started working together, touring, beginning in Des Moines in January 1962. And we've been together ever since. I met her family about my second tour that we had June on, because I asked them to all come and be a part of the show. So I kind of got into those people and became one of their family. And it felt good to go out with them.
What was it like traveling with a family instead of being on your own? Being on your own, leaving the family behind?
I really don't like to do an appearance without June Carter. And what it would be like being alone, it would be awfully lonely to me. I'm very comfortable with, you know, how we do it, my wife and my son on the show and a daughter or two. And it feels so good. I would hate to think that I had to do it all alone.
Did it change your life to have a family that really understood the performing life because it was their life too?
Very much so, yeah, right.
What was the difference? I mean, why Why was that so important?
Well, there's something about families singing together that is just better than any other groups you can pick up or make, you know. If it's family, if it's blood on blood, then it's gonna be better. The voices singing their parts are gonna be tighter, and they're gonna be more on pitch, because it's, as I say, it's a bloodline on bloodline. And it's always really comfortable and easy for me to sing with June or any of those girls.
Johnny Cash, recorded in 1997 after the publication of his autobiography. He's back in the studio recording a new CD. His classic Prison recording, Live from San Quentin, was reissued this week. He also has three new compilation CDs of songs he chose himself. Each CD features songs on one theme, love, murder, and God. Here's a song from the Love CD.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring. Bound by wild desire, I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
Coming up, we remember dancer Harold Nicholas of the Nicholas Brothers. This is Fresh Air. This week we lost an incredible dancer. Harold Nicholas was the younger member of the song and dance duo The Nicholas Brothers. He died Monday at the age of 79 of heart failure. Harold and his brother Fayard started performing in vaudeville as children and went on to perform some of the most remarkable dances in film history in such movies as Stormy Weather and Sun Valley Serenade. They combined tap dance and acrobatics with flips, spins, leaps, and splits. In one of their most famous movie dances, Fayard jumped on a wall and landed in a split. Then Harold topped that by running up another wall, coming out in a backflip, and then finally landing in a split. Before we hear a 1985 interview with Harold Nicholas, let's hear a 1937 Nicholas Brothers recording.
If you're feeling low down, 'cause the skies are gray, just wrap your cares in rhythm and dance. Dance your cares away. Give old gloom the showdown, he'll be on his way. Just wrap your cares in rhythm and dance. Oh, dance your cares away. Now I'm here to teach you all how to make your life a song. Just you keep tapping on wood with your feet, and you can't go wrong. Next time you're in trouble, you'll come out okay. Just wrap your cares in rhythm and dance. I'm gonna give you one more chance. Just wrap your cares in rhythm and dance. I
spoke to Harold Nicholas in 1985. He told me that when he and his brother Fayard were growing up in Philadelphia, their parents were performers.
My brother sometimes would play hooky and go to the shows, and that's where he learned to tap dance. That's how he picked it up, from watching the dancers on stage.
Did he just pick it up, or did anyone teach
him? Picked it up just like that. And then he came home and said, "Listen, I'm going to do something for you." I said, "What?" "I'm going to teach you to dance." At the beginning was kind of, you know, I was, oh, I can't get this because I was left-footed, shall we say. I couldn't do a step only on one foot. That's what it was. But one day when I finally learned how to do the time step, which is the basic of tap dancing, you know, I learned how to do that. Then I was home free.
Yeah. How old were you then?
Oh, Mamma Mia. How old was I then? I was about five or six, because it was right away. It didn't take us too long to get started, you know, because the minute that our parents saw what we could do, when we showed them a routine that we put together, you know, after I had learned and everything, my brother taught me this routine, we put it together and they looked at us and they said, well, that's it. We're going to quit what we're doing and just manage the boys.
Had you been doing the splits and leaps yet when you were that young?
No, not really. Well, I did splits because I was taking acrobatics from a stage manager where my mother and daddy were working in the theater, you know. I would go there, and he would teach me how to tumble a little bit. So from there, I knew how to do. I was doing the splits and doing backflips, things like that.
Now, you got into the Cotton Club when you were, I think, like 8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
That's really young. That's what I'm saying, because,
he taught me when I was young, and right from there, we started at the Horn and Hart at Kitty Hour, that was here, you know, here in Philadelphia. And from there, we just popped right on out.
Did the musicians take you under their wing and become father figures?
Everyone did. Yeah, the musicians, the people around, and the audiences also, you know, because the stars used to come up, and they used to ask to see us and talk to us, and we were the only ones that could go out actually in the audience and talk to the people. Because the people would ask for us. Yeah, because in those days, you know, the blacks couldn't associate with the people. They could work. They worked there and did the show and everything, but they couldn't come out front and sit down and, you know, and talk with the patrons or something like that. But we were allowed to do it, I guess because we were kids also, but we did it.
You started in movies when you were really young. Now, someone who really became a big star when she was really young was Shirley Temple, and mm-hmm. she was given all kinds of leading roles, yeah. and roles that I think you wouldn't have had the opportunity to have because you were black in Hollywood and she mm-hmm. was a white youngster mm-hmm. in Hollywood. How or where were you, especially when you were younger in movies, of the racial divisions that dictated the kind of roles you were going to be given?
Well, I was aware of it because I'm sure they probably wanted to give us maybe some roles, but it would probably have been a role as a bootblack that came out to dance or something, or a role as a houseboy or something that dances around the house or something. So rather than to accept anything like that, we said, well, we'd dance. Just let us dance, do what we know how to do and what we can do. You know, there's no need. So they couldn't find, that they weren't even thinking of trying to write us into the script like they used to do Donald O'Connor or Gene Kelly or Fred Astaire or somebody like that, you know. So all we had to do was just dance. And Cesar Romero said, you know, this is something else, because here we are, the actors, we work our heads off trying to do great in this movie, and even if we do great, here you come along for 4 minutes and you steal the movie, you know. Now, Cesar Romero said this to us one evening, he'd say, hey, and he says, I don't like it. So I told him, I said, well, maybe if they wrote us in the script, it would be a little different, you know. But they never, just Lena Horne was the same way. If you notice, you know, when she was working with MGM, they never included her in the movie, in the script of the movie. She was always, we were the two people, the two top black people in movies that were just doing their number or their thing and absolutely taking the movie, you know, taking it over by storm.
When did you start really putting in a lot of acrobatics into your dance?
That's when we went to Hollywood. You see this film that's in, that's Dancing Now. That was one of the first films that we did for 20th Century Fox Studios. And when we went out there, we met a gentleman by the name of Nick Castle, who was a choreographer, and he worked with us for this movie. But basically, that was really our routine that we did in nightclubs and theaters and everything. And after that, we got a contract with 20th Century Fox Studios to do movies. I think so many movies a year, shall we say. And that's when Nick Kessel started thinking up all these wild ideas, wild tricks to do.
Were you able to do all of them? Did he come up with some tricks that you tried and you just couldn't?
No, there was never anything, because he wouldn't take no for an answer.
Okay, well, let's talk about, let me remember which film it was. The one where you run up the wall?
Mm-hmm.
Was it from down Argentine way?
No, that was Orchestra Wives.
Okay, yeah.
With Glenn Miller's orchestra, remember?
Would you describe that sequence for our listeners who haven't seen
that
it?
That particular sequence?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, to learn that trick, Nick Kessel came and he says, listen, I got an idea. I said, yeah, okay, what is it? Well, Fayard, you see, I want you to run and jump up on the wall. Just jump as high as you can and then jump off into a split. I said, hey, that sounds good. He said, yeah. And Harold, he says, I want you to go on the other side and run up this wall, walk up the wall, turn over, and do a split. I said, you're kidding. He said, no, I'm serious. You can do it. I said, come on, Nick. I mean, you know, why can't I just run and jump like my brother did? He said, no, we got to be different. So he says, don't worry, we'll learn it. And now they got two fellas. This is for learning the trick, you know. They put a belt around me with the straps on the side, you know, ropes on each side, and they held it. He said, now you just go ahead and try it, and the guys will hold it. They won't let you fall. So he said, so I went and I ran and jumped the wall and I, but they held me, you see. I said, you see what I'm telling you? He said, you can do it, he says. I said, keep trying, don't worry about it. Don't you know, forget it. They're going to hold you, don't think about falling. So I did that for about 3 or 4 times. And Nick Kessel went over to the fellas, you know. He said, listen, this time, don't hold him, let him go. When he goes up the wall, let the rope go. So we're running, and I did it. And I ran up the wall, and I did the 1, 2, 3 walk and turned over and went down to the split. And I come up, and I said, oh, boy, you really held that one good. So the guys were outside somewhere. They said, no, you did it by yourself. I dropped right on my knees. But after that, I had no trouble at all doing it. Because I got it out of my system, that was fear, so to speak, you know.
You performed with your brother as a team for years. I mean, from the time that you were like 6 till...
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Julie.
And he's I think, 7 years older than you. Was there was there a lot of competition between you both?
No, not really. No, everyone tells me, you know, if I'm doing something by myself and my brother's around, I mean, it's like he's doing it also. Because he's moving and he's, you know, he's my greatest audience, shall we say, you know. If no one else enjoyed what I was doing, he would enjoy it. So there has never been any friction, shall we say, between us, you know.
Harold Nicholas recorded in 1985. He died Monday at the age of 79. Here he is on the 1946 original cast recording of the Harold Arlen, Johnny Mercer musical, St. Louis Woman.
High luck or low luck or no luck at all, I'll never care if I rise or I fall. I've learned a lesson since we've been apart. I'll do all right if I follow my heart. I walk under ladders, number 13 doesn't scare me, 'cause I'm dressed up in a rainbow and I'm riding on the moon. Had me cornered, but I found out how to shake it, and my true love helped me break it. Now I'm riding on the moon. Oh, yes, you can preach it, sister, while I shout for joy. Oh, yes, say hello to
Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan on the Harry Potter phenomenon. This is Fresh Air. All over the country today, kids are working themselves up into a frenzy of anticipation over a book. Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, considers the powerful spell cast by the Harry Potter books.
Last summer, a friend I hadn't seen in a while brought her 8-year-old daughter over to visit. Chloe loves to read, my friend proudly told me, especially Harry Potter and Nancy Drew books. I told Chloe that I love both those series, too, and that somewhere in my basement was a box full of the Nancy Drews I read as a kid. I told her I thought I had some doubles of the mysteries that she could have, and maybe after lunch we could get them. That's when this shy little girl looked me directly in the eye and said, "Could we open that box now?" The force of the yearning in her voice moved me and made me remember what it was like to be a budding bookworm and to want a book and to have to depend on some adult to get it for you. So I hustled down into my basement, found that box, and broke one of my lifelong rules. I not only gave Chloe some Nancy Drew doubles, I gave her some of my one-of-a-kinds, too. She was thrilled, especially because, as she told me, these were the really old Nancy Drews. I'll bet Chloe and her parents will be standing outside one of our local bookstores tonight, waiting for the clock to strike 12:01. That's when the newest Harry Potter book, Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, officially goes on sale. I know, the hype around Harry Potter is getting hard to take. 21 million copies of the first three books in the series already sold, a record first printing of 3.8 million copies of the new book, which even reviewers couldn't get ahead of time. Front page stories this week in the New York Times and the Washington Post, a Harry Potter movie in the works. But try as I demonically might, I can't find a downside to the Harry Potter phenomenon. In a New Yorker interview earlier this summer, Philip Roth dismally and persuasively observed that TV, the internet, movies, and videos have just about decimated our reading culture. So maybe that's the depressing aspect of this story, that our general expectations for reading habits, juvenile and adult, have fallen so low, it's big news that kids actually want to read some good books. But the redeeming element that makes all this Harry Potter hoopla bearable is that the books are good. This is one of those lucky times in the history of modern popular culture when what people want intersects with artistic quality. To get excited about the Potter books is not just to surrender to a commercial phenomenon. It's also a mark of intelligence and taste, like Beatlemania versus, say, Britney Spears frenzy. The Potter books are richly imaginative, morally complicated, evil does exist, and innocent people actually die, as well as a bit challenging to read. This latest book is 752 pages, and like the others, is sure to be filled with arcane lore about Quidditch, Muggles, and other aspects of Harry's life in the Hogwarts school of witchcraft and wizardry. What else goes into the magic formula? The seriousness of the books, for sure. Most literary critics look down on series fiction as lesser art, but a series can develop characters and their world slowly over years. Certainly the fact that Harry and his friends get older and change from book to book strengthens the illusion that they're really alive. I also think author J.K. Rowling was very smart to make her hero, Harry, an ordinary kid who's been secretly watched for years by the invisible world of wizards because they see him as a prodigy. That powerful fantasy of being recognized as special by somebody out there appeals to readers, young and old. And the whole premise of the Potter books, that there's an invisible, enchanted world existing side by side with the visible, mundane one, is so enticing. It's kind of a parallel to the experience we readers have when we lose ourselves in the ineffable world of a good story. None of these narrative ingredients is exclusive to the Potter books. The magic, as always, derives from how Rowling, the writer, mixes everything up. A dash of dialogue here, an eye of Newt there. I'd love to be about 8 years old and in one of those chaperoned crowds outside a bookstore late tonight, to have an eager community of readers around you who alleviate the necessary solitude of the act of reading by all reading and wanting to talk about the same book. Well, that's what many adults try to create through book groups, but the passing around of brie and crackers, gossip and irony, usually breaks the literary spell. Kid readers' passion for Harry Potter is pure. I'm sure if you stood in one of those bookstore crowds tonight, waiting for those top-secret shipments of Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire to be unsealed, you'd hear more than one kid ask, "Could we open that box now?"
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Roberta Chirac. Our engineer was Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House, Inc. and its Vintage Books Division, paperback publishers of The First World War by John Keegan. And from Saab, introducing the new performance lineup, the 9.5 Arrow and the 9.3 Viggen. Information available at SaabUSA.com and 1-800-SAAB-USA. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Here and I'm here, so what do we care? The time and
on the next Fresh Air, we continue our Monday encore presentations of our series on American popular song with the early theater songs of Jerome Kern, the songs he wrote before such hits as Smoke It's in Your Eyes and The Way You Look Tonight. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
The skies are fair everywhere, and the sun seems to shine. And now